Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of The Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. I'm your host, Brian J. Rowan, joined as always by my two compatriots. There is Nick Newman, associate editor for The Film Stage. Unless he's not.
I thought it would be appropriate not to say anything.
Oh, you're doing your Ryan Gosling impression?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, that's funny.
And then there's Danny King, writer for The Film Stage.
Hello, welcome, Brian. Good to hear from you.
Thank you. It's great to hear from you as well.
Hey, can Danny do his Ryan Gosling impersonation?
Yeah, Danny, do your impression of Ryan Gosling.
Yeah, okay. Do you want to fight?
Oh, my God. Anyway, today we will be talking about the newest film by Nicholas Winding Refn, Only God Forgives, starring Ryan Gosling and Kristin Scott Thomas. Before we get into that, however, we will be having a very brief discussion of some local movie announcements and news. Before we get into all that, though, reminder to everyone out there to give us a rating and a comment on iTunes because we are attention whores. Also, you can email us at podcast@thefilmstage.com if you are so inclined. That's about it. So there wasn't a lot of really heavy movie news going on, and we didn't want to do just another retrospective on a director, even though Nicholas Winding Refn would be quite an interesting choice. However, if you are interested in knowing some thoughts on his entire filmography, Nick Newman, you have an article over at The Film Stage, do you not?
I do, yeah.
All right, so plug for that. I saw that Dave Chen from the Slash Film cast had some thoughts on it.
Yeah, that was kind of weird.
A little bit weird.
But yeah, that seemed weird.
What are you going to do?
I think he said that it made him angry.
Yeah, it did. I inspired rage, which means that I did something right in a list countdown, finally.
If a list doesn't inspire some rage, you're not doing it right.
Yeah.
Never aim for the middle. Anyway, so today we're just going to go through, each of us is going to say something either news-related or trailer-related or film-related that we wanted to draw some attention to and get some opinions on. So, Danny, why don't you kick us off?
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, I know one item that caught my eye on the site this week was a trailer for Southcliffe, which is a upcoming miniseries from Sean Durkin, who directed Martha Marcy May Marlene. And I didn't even watch the trailer when it went up, but when we decided to do this little round table, I gave it a look and it was pretty good. It looks sort of like a carbon copy of a lot of things that have been going around lately, mostly like Top of the Lake, with like these crime dramas that look very overcast, and like people in the trailer are talking about how weird Southcliffe is, and then like Southcliffe shows up as the title, and it's like, okay, this will probably be about a creepy town.
Speaking in a distinctive regional accent.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Very much. So hopefully subtitles when it's released. But yeah, I mean, I like Top of the Lake, and this looks like well shot. And I don't think Sean Durkin has directed anything in a couple of years, so be interesting how he adapts to the smaller screen.
All right. And Nick, have you seen this trailer as well?
Yeah, I gave it a gander.
What were your thoughts on it?
It looks good. I was kind of surprised, A, because I didn't know that this even existed. I had kind of been wondering what Sean Durkin was up to after his little Sundance smash. But as it turns out, this is what he's up to, so good for him, I guess, getting work. But also, I don't know, it didn't really remind me too strongly of Martha Marcy sort of formally, which, like the films in that borderline production company line, After School and Simon Killer, kind of has this very Haneke-esque style to it. I didn't really detect that here, which might be good, because one of my problems with Martha Marcy was that it felt a little too much like his work. the noted Austrian. So maybe this diversion of sorts will be good, and maybe, I don't know, maybe working in TV in a longer format will help Durkin kind of get the creative juices flowing a little more, because I'd like to see him back in the ring.
Yeah, I was I had no idea this was coming out either, and having just watched the trailer, I have to say that I'm interested. It's I don't know, it kind of reminded me of the movie Beautiful Boy. Did anyone see that?
No.
It was a school shooting, and then the way that the parents dealt with it. And this seems like, you know, following this mass shooting that resembles obliquely the Port Arthur massacre that happened in Australia in 1996, if anyone remembers that. It's going to be an examination of the town and the people who were affected by it. Maybe a bad thing that I, in the middle of watching this trailer where there's a lot of hysterics and people crying and talking about things that they didn't realize, I got a real heavy Twin Peaks vibe, and in that show, the histrionics were played for laughs, so I don't know. There's something to be said for being overly earnest, and it's going to depend a lot on the actors and the direction and the writing, but I'm still intrigued for it. I'm looking forward to it.
I mean, yeah, most shows that take the strange small town sort of design owe something to the Lynch Frost series to various extents. You know, it's kind of something you can't avoid, and I don't know. I don't think it's a huge issue per se, but it's definitely there.
All right, excellent. Well, Nick, what about yourself? What is something that you wanted to chat about?
So this is something maybe not as highbrow, but the news just came in. I'm actually writing this up for the site right now. Surreptitiously as I listen and speak, that DC is going to make a Superman-Batman team-up movie.
This has just hit Twitter, people. This is like, you know what, this is like the first episode of the newsroom.
Wow.
You know, that's what
I just watched the season premiere last night, and that show is still shitty.
It's really bad.
So,
You posted on Facebook something about, like, who let the newsroom come back, and I said something along the lines of, I'm enjoying the hell out of hating the shit out of this.
Yeah, and, man, that show really hates women.
Hates women.
It's really uncomfortable to watch, because I was thinking, there's one scene, actually, toward the end with, this is so far off topic, where, anyway, if you took a shot for every sort of misogynistic element in a scene, you would probably die.
Does this take place in a bar?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, anyway.
Though I guess you could almost count that Jim in that show counts as a woman.
I mean, he is... I'm surprised he hasn't killed himself, honestly, because it's just the way he's written. It's... Give the guy a break. Okay, yeah. So...
we DC's should have a... To, I'm just going to say we should have an episode where we talk about the newsroom.
I would do it, yeah.
Okay.
So DC is doing this now, and it would appear that Henry Cavill will return to play Kal-El, and... Zack Snyder is going to direct, and David S. Goyer will write. So I think Christopher Nolan might be producing. So it's that basic team. Christian Bale isn't coming back because he's since retired, and this takes place in a new universe, so on and so forth. Anyway, I mean, believe it or not, this will seem difficult to believe because this doesn't feel like this was long ago. Today's actually the one-year anniversary, when we're recording, of The Dark Knight Rises release.
What?
And... Now, all of a sudden, we're launching into a new Batman, and this is only something like a month after Man of Steel was released. It feels as if they're moving a little too quickly on this kind of thing, and I'm just not really sure what this signifies for much of the studio, sort of that industry inside of film, but it's not very encouraging to see them just kind of jump into this thing. It feels as if maybe, you know, you could expand the character a little more. And
now
because this is going to be, I guess this will be Man of Steel 2.
Okay, that was my question. I wasn't sure if it was like a spinoff or a Man of Steel 2 or the new Batman.
So I don't know. It's very odd, and I don't know if anybody has thoughts on...
I mean, we thought it was going to be odd when the Avengers came out. And, you know, that worked, but they built up a lot to it. But also the movies that they built up to it with were not universally great. So I don't know. They're going to get money from it. I'm kind of giving up on the superhero thing. It's not special anymore. I just don't... I'm not, like, overtly excited for any of the new crop of Marvel films coming out. I mean, I enjoyed Man of Steel, and it was one of my most anticipated of the summer, but, I mean, like, it's just... I don't care anymore. I've been thinking about how much I'm looking forward to the next Fast and Furious movie.
Mm.
Like, that's good. I enjoy that. That's a crazy, surprising thing, but I'm just getting really tired of all this stuff. So this is, it could be interesting. I don't know how they'll make it interesting, because, I mean, Batman versus Superman is a thing that's always been kind of a joke, or I guess it's happened, but I just, it's one of those things, Superman, like, what the hell can you do?
Unless, well, it's
Batman's
also,
like, I got some kryptonite.
Well, Wolfgang Peterson was going to make a, such a film back
that
in, like, 2005
that
or something.
Been amazing.
But then there was always the joke, I think it was on, like, Late Night with Conan O'Brien, back when that show was still on, he said, so it's basically, you know, the most powerful being the planet Earth has ever seen versus a rich guy with a cape and a hook. It doesn't really, it doesn't seem like there's much potential for conflict there.
Yeah, that's the problem. I don't really know. I'm assuming that it'll be like versus, but only insofar as like the FBI and local cops will be against one another at the first half of a movie. You know, jurisdictional pissing contest followed by let's team up and bring this guy down.
It'd be great if it was My Dinner with Andre-esque drama with the two actors dressed in their suits just talking.
In the Fortress of Solitude or the Batcave. I was going to say, like, first...
Or just at a restaurant.
First scene of Pulp Fiction style. I would enjoy the hell out of that.
Yeah.
I don't know. Danny, what do you think about this?
Do we know when the release date is?
It's 2015.
2015.
So it's not far off. Really.
It's my most anticipated of 2015. It's going to be incredible.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm going to go tweet about it. I'll be right back.
Okay. All right. Well, I just wanted to talk about going to Danny's thing. A trailer that came out this week for 12 Years a Slave. I think everyone knows that I'm a fan of Steve McQueen and Michael Fassbender and Chip Patel Ejiofor. Did I get that right? Did I nail that?
I say Chiwetel Ejiofor.
Okay, I have no idea how he would prefer to be pronounced, but Chiwetel is a good actor, a great actor, in my opinion. I've loved him in almost everything he's in, and he's in Red Belt, so he'll always have a place in my heart. And the new trailer came out for that film, 12 Years a Slave, and I enjoyed it quite a bit. And I've been telling everyone I know to watch it, and I've actually started reading the book, 12 Years a Slave.
Oh, I might want to do that.
I read that last summer.
Did you enjoy it?
I mean, you know, it's a very frank account of a horrible institution and being trapped in it, but it is a very well-written book, and it's a gripping read, very eye-opening. It actually kind of told me a lot about the institution of slavery that I didn't realize.
Yeah, I'm only a couple chapters into it, and I can say that everything you're saying is 100% correct.
Yeah.
Like, you try to fathom the inhumanity that man visited upon man in the institution of slavery, and it, your imagination ain't good enough, I'll tell you that much. And, it is surprising that if I'm reading the book correctly, he wrote this thing like just a couple months after getting free. Like, he came home from this terrible ordeal and he was like, all right, now I gotta write about that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's insanely well written, compulsively readable. He's a very gifted writer. So I'm reading the book and I saw the trailer and I'm looking forward to that, and it's become, along with Gravity and The Wolf of Wall Street, one of my most anticipated films of the year to come. Or the remainder of the year, I guess, is the more correct way to say that.
Mm-hmm.
Nick and Danny, you've seen the trailer. What do you all think?
Well, now I'm anticipating reading the book just as much as the film. But I think it's a good trailer. It'll be interesting to see kind of how Steve McQueen is incorporated into what looks to be kind of like an award season type project. And I don't want to put any stigma on that. I don't mean that in a negative or positive way. It's just like, it's definitely going to be a different kind of,
it's not going to be Hunger.
Yeah. It's not going to be Hunger. So it'll be as interesting as the film is going to be. It'll also be interesting to see kind of if he continues to work in this kind of vein going forward, and how he sort of handles this environment versus hunger.
Yeah, but I mean, even Shame had a fairly rote trailer, but the film itself was a lot more than it appeared.
Yeah, that's a
very
good point.
Yeah, it's very, nah?
No, I said yeah.
Oh, okay. You had a dismissive tone to it.
Oh.
But, I mean, it's very easy to cut a trailer and put some orchestral scoring on it that makes it seem simple.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I'm...
Fassbender looks disturbing.
Yeah, he's probably gonna... I'm assuming, gonna steal the show every now and then. Just like, good lord. Yeah, if you haven't seen it, watch the trailer. Michael Fassbender is a force of nature, and Chiwetel Ejiofor is... incredible in it looking as well. There's one scene in the trailer that I can already tell in the movie is probably going to like tear my heart out, and it's him singing with a group of slaves.
Oh, are you going to be okay?
No, I'm not going to be okay. I'm going to cry, man. I know it. It's going to be my new Up.
Yeah, I'm a little more skeptical just because the trailer didn't do a whole lot for me.
Yeah.
But
it's understandable.
It just looks, if I didn't know who this was from, I think this was another kind of Oscar-y
and I
movie
think that
about
they're kind of depending on that
racial mistreatment or something.
Yeah.
And
it's going to be another Amistad.
Yeah, I mean, I actually kind of like Amistad, but it's not what I want to see.
Amistad,
but it's
yeah.
not what I want to see from McQueen. So
I'm assuming it's a bait and switch.
Yeah, you know I'm hoping that he can... That's the thing. When this project was announced, I thought to myself, well, how do you apply those proclivities as a film artist to this kind of story? And as I was reading the book, I kept asking myself that. I thought it would have to be extremely stripped down. This looks like a relatively faithful adaptation of the text. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, we'll see. I'm not... you know, it's not like this has completely diminished my expectations, but I think maybe I have to realign them a bit. We'll see.
Yeah, we will indeed. And that comes out in October. It got bumped up, and I'm looking forward to it. So that's it for our quick jaunt through the new happenings that were going on in the movie world this week. So let's get into our primary review, the divisive, violent, highly stylized film from Nicholas Winding Refn, Only God Forgives, starring Ryan Gosling, Kristen Scott Thomas, and Vidhya Panjangarm.
Ask him why he killed my brother.
I die in a coffee shop.
Did you get the guy that did it?
It's a little more complicated than that, mother.
He hasn't told you, has he? There's someone else involved. Some cop.
You can't go around killing cops anymore.
So this is a film that stars Ryan Gosling, as we've said, as one of a pair of brothers living in Bangkok who run a kickboxing gym as a front for a drug operation. Something happens, one has to avenge the other, and their mom shows up, spitting fire and demanding blood. So let's talk about this, gentlemen. Only God Forgives. First, before you give your opinion, I'd like us to say what we've thought of Refn's previous work. And then we can talk about what we thought about this. So, Danny, what are your thoughts on his previous work and Only God Forgives?
Well, I haven't seen anything pre-Bronson. And actually reading Nick's write-up made me really interested to go back and watch them. I didn't realize he was such a frequent collaborator with Mads Mikkelsen, who seemed like he was in almost all of those early films. And so... yeah, I'm looking forward to doing that sometime soon. Bronson, I kind of remember, you know, it's been a while. I kind of remember that mostly as a kind of showcase for Tom Hardy. I don't remember being particularly kind of interested in the film. I thought it was kind of just like an assault of violent and disturbing material. And this is something that will come back in Valhalla Rising and also Only God Forgives. Drive is definitely the film I'm most enthusiastic about, and it's interesting that it's kind of adapted from a book, so it feels like Refn is working with like a preset character in a location, and he's sort of bringing his sensibility to that and working with it, And I think that's you get a different feeling in that film than you do in something like Only God Forgives, just in terms of character building and sort of sensibility. But I mean, overall, he is a very kind of arresting visual stylist, and I look forward to seeing what he comes up with in the future and in the past and in the present.
Not in the present.
All right, and Nick.
So the thing about Only God Forgives, which I think is key to my appreciation of the movie, is that I don't really take it seriously. I don't think that this is a quote-unquote serious film. To me, it's a very dark comedy, and it's an absurdist work, which might sound kind of off-key, but I do think the movie is clearly trying to go for this sort of seductive but at the same time thin characterization, and the way it's playing with its locations and its characters is, again, it's by design, it's very thin, and you're supposed to just sort of be immersed in what's there. And I think that it's a kind of a dangerous idea, because what you actually get is something which doesn't exactly work as a story or a character piece, but it is a pretty, I found myself very sort of entranced by it from beginning to end, even if I could understand where it was not working and where perhaps Winding Refn could have fleshed things out a bit more, where he could have stood to flesh them out, no matter what else he's intending. But I had a surprising amount of fun with it, which is weird to say for a movie that's this dark and brutal. As a fan of his, to kind of see him go back to a movie like Valhalla Rising was, it was worthwhile. And I don't know, I mean, a lot of the reaction seems to come from people who, I'm not saying this is necessarily true of Danny or maybe Brian, I don't know how you feel about the film, but a lot of the reaction seems to come from sort of this resentment where people want to Drive to.
Yeah.
And that's very much, this is very much not that. This was actually supposed to be made before Drive. So maybe that would tell you something about sort of the difference between the two films. And I don't know, I'm basically fine with the difference. I don't think the movie is very significant, and I don't think there's really a lot to it, but it's a bit of fun. You know, it's got some character.
It certainly does. So I watched this film last night.
VOD?
VOD, yeah.
The rest only of you saw this only in, VOD forgives.
Only VOD forgives.
Only VOD forgives Refn.
Thank you, Danny. Only VOD forgives. Yeah, so I watched this last night, and I gotta say, I was very ambivalent on it for probably the first couple of hours after I'd seen it. However, today, thinking back on it and realizing that I still have something like 10 hours until the 24-hour viewing period stops, I guess? Because you rent something on VOD, you keep it for up to 30 days, but once you've watched it or started it, you have 24 hours to watch it in.
Mm.
So I was like, holy shit, I gotta get home. I have to podcast on this, and I have to see it again. So I think I'm pretty positive on it. I gotta say, I too was vaguely expecting Drive 2, and when I realized that I wasn't gonna get that, I actually started to like it even more. It's a challenging film in as much as not a lot of dialogue is spoken, and what it is spoken, it's spoken by despicable people who you wish would stop speaking. And the nominal hero is just a stoic mute who doesn't... It's almost through inaction that he acts. And it's once you start to wrap your mind around things like that and you start to understand what the movie is doing and saying, to me it became much clearer and I enjoyed it a lot more. So I've liked everything that I've seen by Refn. I enjoyed Bronson and Drive, obviously, and I was looking forward to this, and I think I was just a little put off by the fact that this movie kind of flips all of his previous English language meditations on violence kind of on their head, and I really liked it. I liked it a lot. The music is fantastic, the cinematography is beautiful and ugly all at once. It's kind of grotesquely appealing, and... Yeah, like the character interactions, such as they are brief, but they're very affecting. And I found myself really enjoying my time with this film. And like I said, I want to see it again before I lose that window.
You say brief but affecting, and I think that I think this is best exemplified by an actor named Tom Burke. Is his name?
It's possible.
Maybe. Yeah. Tom Burke, that's his name, who plays the brother, Billy.
Yeah.
Is only on screen for 4 or 5 minutes, and that's within the first 10 minutes of the movie. But I found his work here very haunting.
Yeah, and, that guy is
creepy.
Yeah.
Just sort of the very matter-of-fact way where he says, you know, I want to have sex with a 16-year-old.
No, he initially says 14.
Oh, 14-year-old, right.
Yeah, so that whole scene in the bar initially is really masterfully macabre and understated, mm-hmm. and a little bit, well, really disturbing.
And what I especially like is how it's this very frank, very horrifying statement, and there's no explanation for it. There's no, there's really no instigation. There's no understanding. And I think that's what a lot of the movie is kind of operating on. And I completely understand why that would not work for somebody, and they think it's nonsense. It would, you know, I'd hear that and I'd go, yeah, sure, okay. But for me, it was properly effective. And, you know, a lot of that comes down to actually the actor, in this case, Tom Burke, fleshing out what's already on the page.
Right.
Which is to say, not much. You can tell that Ruffin is pretty reliant upon almost everything but the screenplay itself. He's reliant upon sort of this very stoic gaze, these very reserved performances, this lurid lighting. All of that is what you say, Brian. It's more like a mood piece. Part of the problem is that I feel like Refn's mood is pretty one note. There's only the occasional flourish, usually of a, like you said, macabre, almost like a macabre humor, which comes about particularly through karaoke, which I wasn't expecting.
Yeah. Finish your thought and then
I was gonna say those are sort of the moments where the movie comes up for air, but I think part of the problem is that it doesn't do it really often enough, and so it's not that I was miserable watching the movie. I was actually enjoying myself. I'm just saying that it is still a miserable film.
Yeah, and it is rough to get through.
And I think that maybe even at 90 minutes, you can really feel that. And if it doesn't, if that doesn't click, yeah, it makes perfect sense because it's not a, yeah, not everybody's cup of tea.
No, it definitely isn't. And I actually like the performance of Tom Burke and Ryan Gosling. They're very much of a piece, and it's just the way that they act out the things that they have inside them that mm-hmm. separates them. And I loved the duality in that, and we can talk about that more in spoilers. But yeah, Burke was haunting. And this movie, one of the films that I kept coming back to in my mind was Last Year at Marienbad.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of scenes in this of especially the police chief. Is that... He was a police chief or some sort of police officer.
Yeah.
Played by Vidhya Sarangram.
Yeah, his character is Lieutenant Chang.
Yes. So there's a lot. He kind of presides over everything with this like absolute moral clarity and cool. And there are many scenes where he just steps very, very directly and very stoically. He's very considered in all of his movements, and there are scenes where people are just sitting there watching him. And I kept having flashbacks to Last Year at Marienbad, where there would be this thing happening in the middle of the room, and all the other people would be sitting motionless, just considering. And yeah, he's fantastic in this film. And the way that his character kind of morphs in our eyes throughout the course of the film was, for me, one of the best parts of the movie. And so I wanted to bring that up because mm-hmm. that man deserves some props for that. And also just it might be one of the reasons why I like the movie so much. That kind of, if you know Marienbad and if you understand, you know, these hallucinogenic edits and flashbacks and thoughts that appear to be occurring throughout the movie, it really helps you to gather it into yourself and to better understand it instead of just looking for the linear narrative that we may have been looking for after Drive.
Mm-hmm. What did we think of Kristen Scott Thomas.
Oh, which my is God.
The most expressive performance. I have to say, I've
almost
never.
I want to give her her own section where we talk about her.
I've never been a Kristen Scott Thomas fan, really. Right. She's never really been my cup of tea. I think that maybe part of the reason I enjoyed her here is because she was breaking out from what I thought was sort of this very reserved, kind of bland on-screen presence by just sort of exploding in a way.
Yeah, she is absolutely enthralling. Like,
yeah.
I would love a prequel to this film just so we can get even more of the backstory between her and her sons. Like, her introduction in this film is just masterful. It's one of those scenes that so definitely and automatically sets up the character. It's just, she is fantastic. She is every horrible Lady Macbeth-style movie matriarch rolled into one and then just, like, dyed blonde. Danny, what are your thoughts?
I would say that her character kind of got, her character in the performance kind of got less and less appealing to me as the film went on. And the way Refn kind of handles that character maybe sort of reflects what I don't like about his sense of humor in this film, because I do think that opening scene with her is really good, because you kind of have an actual situation where her response is reasonable, because her son's just died and she can't get a hotel room or something, and so she's pissed off. And that's like a reasonable feeling to have. But through her kind of demeanor and her inflection, you can sense that the character's just insane, and it's really funny. But then you get to a scene like one where she's having dinner with Ryan Gosling and this prostitute, and the humor just like wasn't there for me. And I don't even want to say some of the lines that Refn gives her, but it's just like, I don't know who that's funny for or why it's funny. And it's actually an interesting thing that's been brought up, is that this movie was meant to be made before Drive. But a lot of it, in terms of how Gosling is treated, both by the film and by this mother character, feels like a direct subversion of that film.
Yes.
And so I think, you know, while the concept might have been in Refn's head before Drive, it was completely changed by it. And I don't know, I think that's an interesting idea, but it's just kind of pummels you with this one note of him as this like emasculated, passive guy. And the way she kind of just tears him apart got a little bit just sort of unsettling for me. I didn't really find it funny.
You got some mama issues, Danny?
No.
It's like a little too close to home.
No, that's not it.
Okay. Just making sure.
Yeah.
I absolutely loved her subtle, not even subtle, just cutting, blunt decimation of his character in every scene they were in. That was like a high point for me.
Interesting.
Yeah, that dinner scene was absolutely fantastic.
Fascinating.
The more I think about it, I think I loved this film, guys.
Yeah, it was like you're slowly getting to the point where you're like a big fan.
This movie kind of is one of the best movies I've seen this year.
Really?
I don't know about that. I do know that I enjoyed it quite a bit. I think if I go back over it, it might even grow in my estimation. There's been a lot of films that have done exactly what I expect them to recently, and this movie goes against all of that. And so it might just be that, like, refreshing palate cleansing. Just like, it's like a cool breeze coming through a stultifying, still, like, you know, awful, decrepit room, and it just clears everything out. And watching it was just, I won't say a delight, but it was definitely more fun than sitting through The Lone Ranger or Francis Ha or Man of Steel. In terms of movies that I've enjoyed and that have given me something that I feel like I haven't seen before, this would have to be one of them.
Well, I think also kind of about how your reaction has sort of become more positive. It's a better film if you think of it kind of like on a scene by scene basis. Like, if I were to watch one scene every day, it would be kind of a cool film, because he is a very accomplished stylist, and he has these weird editing rhythms that sort of kind of catch your attention. But I just think if when you put it all together and when you're kind of forced to sit through it, it doesn't add up to a pleasant experience for me.
Well, yeah,
but,
if you have to use the term forced to describe the act of seeing a movie, that doesn't say a lot about it.
Yeah.
Now, Nick, you seem to take umbrage with me saying that this movie was refreshing compared to the other ones that we've watched. Is it just because of that one particular?
I thought your shot at Francis Ha was a little...
It wasn't a shot. I wasn't saying, like, Francis Ha is the new RIPD. I would never want to see it again. I'm just saying, like, we've watched... I was trying to give the breadth of the films.
No, I guess maybe as someone who has seen all of Munding Refn's films, maybe it's just not... It doesn't feel like much that's new to me, really.
And that's very possible, yeah.
Yeah, this is sort of in line with what he's done, which is fine because I like what he does. I know that a lot of people have a big problem with it, and I can understand. I get it, but to me, it basically works. Now, as for, you know, I mean, I guess I agree with Danny that it is a movie which sort of holds up better in my memory than when I actually saw it, just because, yeah, you think about it on a scene-by-scene basis, it's pretty neat. The problem is that I don't know what this movie is trying to say, and I feel like it is trying to say something, but
I understand what you're saying. That was one of the questions I had after seeing the movie initially, before I had a chance to really think about it. And I think that if we're going to examine that, it might be a good time to get into spoilers.
Mm-hmm.
Good call.
All right, excellent. So, Only God Forgives. Let's give our like one word recommendation before we move on. So, Danny?
It is a fascinatingly miserable 90 minutes.
Nick?
If you're intrigued, it's available on VOD, and I would also say that, you know, it only takes you 90 minutes, so you'll be... It's weird. It's like I'm recommending, like, a diet or something. No. What I would say is that, you know, for $7 and 90 minutes, it can be yours. But also, if you're going to see it, make sure you're in the proper mood for it and understand exactly what you're getting. Because if you want to have a rip-roaring good time, steer clear, my friends. Otherwise, yeah, if you think that this is for you, I'd say give it a shot. I don't think there'll be much pain in that.
All right. And I'm going to say that if you're cool with violence and you're looking for an interesting, challenging, crazy film, definitely check this one out. If you think that you would ever be in the mood for this, I can say 100% that I was satisfied. I can't tell everyone to go out and see it, but it's definitely a pretty fantastic film. So let's talk spoilers. Nick, you had questions regarding what the film is about. Would you like to flesh out your uncertainty towards the message of the film?
So the movie is sort of painted in these big, bold letters from beginning to end, and it's so kind of severe in its communication that there's something that's trying to be stated, but I don't think there's anything of tantamount importance that is actually coming through here. Maybe, I mean, it's funny because the movie premiered at Cannes, and there was sort of this small joke on Twitter right after where a lot of people came out going like, but I didn't really like that very much. And then they read in the press notes Nicholas Winding Refn saying what the movie was about, sort of under the surface what it was about. And nobody, i.e. a group of very smart critics, actually saw what he claims was in the film. Because he said, you know, I want to make a movie about a man who fights God. And that's my Nicholas Winding Refn impersonation. But I don't know if that's really here, I guess.
I got that.
Did you really?
Yeah, no, I'm completely 100% serious. When we get into it, you will understand.
I was going to say, I mean, I suppose Lieutenant Chang could be
absolutely
God, but I don't know. I mean, I guess this would be the Old Testament God, the really angry fire and brimstone one.
Yeah, this is definitely Old Testament God. And what's really what I'll say before you go on is, in my estimation of the film, he is God as personified, like you said, in that Old Testament way. He is the man-made God, whereas somewhere else there might be the better, truer God. that right. doesn't respond that way.
So there are a few problems here. One is that I don't think there's anything in the movie which so strongly suggests that,
oh,
really.
We'll get into it.
Secondly is that if it is, then I just don't understand what the movie is really saying by making him God. I don't understand why that's actually important and why that actually works, what significance that holds. It sort of feels to me, do you remember in like fifth grade or something when you did a project for school and you kind of realized there wasn't really much of a point to it?
Absolutely.
Or maybe, you know, a few years ago when you're in college even. Or maybe at work.
Or like
last
when you're
week.
At work on Friday and you're doing it.
Yeah. And so you kind of say stops. Like, well, what it's really saying is, and you kind of cherry pick certain elements of your creation to support that very thin idea. That's sort of what it feels like to me, because there's little about the action or the incidents in this movie which have a hugely religious undertone. And sure, there's a thing about forgiveness, there's a thing about violence, but so what? I mean, that's in practically every action film ever made, and those don't, I don't think Commando is really about fighting God, really, unless Arnold Schwarzenegger is God in that film, which I could see, but I don't know if that's the case. So, his sort of indication there is, it raises an eyebrow.
Well, in my head, watching the film, we see Billy, who is the brother who gets his brains bashed in with a pipe after he rapes and murders a 16-year-old, and he is just obviously a straight-up, vicious, evil, existentially empty, morally bankrupt person. And then there's his brother, who has all of those impulses towards violence, but none of the viciousness or cruelty that would lead him to act on them in the same way. He's kind of this rudderless agent of violence that has no outlet for it. And then you have Chang, who he finds this murder, he finds the murderer, and he offers the father the opportunity to exact vengeance. And the father does it. He takes the situation into his own hands and beats a guy's brains in. But then Chang points out that none of this would have happened if the father had been a better father in the first place. And so to exact a kind of reckoning and to make all things equal or, you know, whatever it is in his mind, he chops off this father's hand. And that's kind of his, like, it's over now. Like, he's righted the wrongs that created the greater wrong. And it's done. It's done to him. But unfortunately, it's set up this other balance, because even though Ryan Gosling, who is a normal-ish, you know, moral-ish person, is willing to let things go, his mother, who is another agent of pure chaos, comes in, and she's coming at them. She wants it to keep going. And so really, Chang isn't some maniac who's on his way to destroy this crime family. He's only correcting the wrongs that have been done that are going to lead to more wrongs. And that's kind of what the last scene of the film is saying, too. You know, like, Gosling, first of all, that fight scene where Chang and Gosling's character Julian fight.
I think fight is putting it kindly.
Fight is, yeah, that's a most one-sided fight ever. And it was incredible, because I thought, you know, here we're going to get the epic showdown that's teased in all the trailers with Gosling's, you know, stoic, unhinged guy saying, you know, want to fight. And then he gets his ass handed to him. Mm-hmm. And it's beautiful. And this is one of those films where I just, like, they throw punches that look like they are meant to hurt. Mm. Like, there's nothing false looking about this moment.
It kind of brought me back to a very different movie, Killing Them Softly.
Yeah.
Remember when we discussed that? There's a scene where Ray Liotta is
beaten.
Which is very brutal moment because of the way the sound is orchestrated there.
Right.
That was, you know, that came to mind here.
Absolutely. No, I agree.
Just wanted to throw that in.
And so after that, it's kind of over. Again, they just have to take out the mother now. But she sets off this moment where Gosling and another guy are in the house. And they're gonna kill his family. They're gonna kill Chang's family. And so Gosling again taps into that slight innate goodness that he has, saves the daughter, doesn't have time to save the mother, comes home, finds his own mother stabbed in the throat and dead, and then we get a dual biblical reference when he first stabs her in the side to make sure that she is dead, as the as I think it was Longinus did to Christ on the cross. And then, just to eradicate any doubts that he may have regarding the truth of what he's seeing, he sticks his hand in her side, as Thomas did. So that's a little heavy-handed, but I can get over it.
See, those are good observations, but this goes back to my problem with sort of direction, the intent that he's taking. So is the mother Christ, or what? How do you apply that metaphor?
I don't know that. I don't know that it goes,
because if Kristen Scott Thompson's character is Christ, I have no idea what this is saying.
I think it's just the evocation of Christian themes rather than, you know, fully conforming to the Bible, because there's nothing to say that Chang is responsible for her creation. Mm-hmm. And I mean, we find out that Gosling, his mother, made him kill his father. So then you get a good hardcore dash of Oedipus in there too. Because I think it's pretty well stated that that mother has done some things with her sons.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then Gosling is found and taken out to the woods, and the implication is that he has had his arms chopped off.
Mm-hmm.
Lower arms. He's got the shoulder down to the elbow, I think. But, and we get this repeated imagery of him balling up his fists and kind of considering them, because he knows that he has to do something with them, but he doesn't know what or how to force it out into the world. And so almost at this point, the loss of his fists, his ability to cause violence, is almost like a release for him. And again, you know, like, Chang could have murdered him, but that's not what was required. Like, Gosling saved his daughter, but he also was a part of the act that took his wife. So I saw Chang towards the end of the film as a good guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he has the opportunity to kill two people and only kills one of them because the other, you know, kind of accepts what he did, but he also, you know, makes a plea for the life of his son. And I think Chang sees that. He sees that it wasn't, you know, evil or malintent that made this man do it, but, you know, the desire to save and protect his child.
Mm-hmm.
So see,
these are all very interesting, well illustrated points. You just
don't see it.
It's not even so much that I don't see it. I just don't think it's potent enough to actually.
And I can get that. Work. You know, it might.
But also, I don't see it.
It's one of those things. Like, your mileage may vary. For me, as I discovered it, it was very clear, and I enjoyed the hell out of it.
Okay. Does Danny have any?
Yeah, Danny, you want to?
I was really enjoying just listening to Brian interpret the movie more than I was like enjoying watching the movie. But
all right.
To me, I wonder if part of the issue there in why some of those things didn't necessarily come across to me is like the balance between the Gosling character and the lieutenant. Because while I was watching the film, you know so much more about Gosling's character that he was the one I was just engaging with the most. So for me, like the main idea or the main concept I was taking away from the film was sort of this guy who clearly has an aversion to violence is kind of caught inside a world that is nothing but violence, and sort of like the conflict that results there. Because, like you said, the fight he has with the lieutenant, where he just gets pummeled, is a really good scene. Not only just jarring physically, but because you can sense he's not even enjoying the fight, and he just like hates all these things he's caught up in. And there's a really funny line where Kristen Scott Thomas asks him to kind of get revenge for his brother's death, and he's like, "Yeah, I think he like raped and killed a prostitute, so I don't know if I'm gonna do that." And she's like,
"I'm sure he had his reasons."
Yeah, she's like, "No, you're gonna do it. You're gonna do it."
Yeah, it's these conflicts that are the most interesting, because there's the, you know, the connection to morality and the subservience to morality, and then there's the subservience to the law and to vengeance and then to family, and the way that they kind of interact is interesting to me. But Danny, go ahead. You were saying.
Yeah, well, So yeah, maybe like if I were watched the film again, if I just like looked at the Chang character as more of like maybe the main character, the main idea of the movie, I would get more out of it. I think something about having Ryan Gosling in this movie and having it come right after Drive maybe kind of forces like an imbalance in the focus, because I wasn't picking up on a lot of the things you mentioned. And I don't know if that was the reason.
You talk about sort of the perception that this movie is saddled with coming after Drive, and there was sort of a criticism that surrounded that movie, which I found odd, where people thought that it was too macho, and it was sort of unbelievable that Ryan Gosling would be this unbeatable thing, which I don't think really was true about the film. I think if you look at it more closely, you can see that that's not the case, really. He more thinks he's a great hero than he actually is.
Yeah.
Secondly,
there's
but he looks,
a song that explicates that in the movie.
Yes, but the idea is that he looks cool while he's doing it. Secondly, is that, you know, this movie really completely erases that idea because, I mean, I don't know what other word to use here. Julian is kind of a pussy.
Oh, yeah.
And he's so hilariously ineffectual, and he has no personality, and he cannot hold his own in a fight. He can't even come close to it. And
maybe,
mother has to...
Well, here's the thing. Do you remember that scene where he, like, smashed the glass into someone's face and then...
Yeah, that was weird.
What was that? Like,
yeah, that's
that
was strange.
One lingering question I have. Like, he's, like...
Wasn't that... So I saw the movie, like, almost 2 weeks ago, so maybe my memory of it... Maybe my memory of that moment is a little hazy. Did he think that the man was looking at the woman, Mai?
I don't know if he was looking at her, but he was definitely like laughing and being jovial.
Okay.
He kind of just seemed to break Ryan Gosling's peace.
Okay.
And that
okay.
sucks because the guy, he walks over to him and the guy's like, "Hey, you want some whiskey?" And then Ryan Gosling, you know how I respond to whiskey guys. Like, if you offer me whiskey, I'm your best friend. Ryan Gosling, on the other hand, will smash a glass into your face, throw you into a hallway, and then drag you away by your upper jaw.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, like, it's the thing, like, he's obviously got a proclivity towards violence, and he obviously has the capacity for it. I just think he was incredibly overmatched when he decided to fight God.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just going to call him God now.
So, I mean, I think the movie is very... this goes back to sort of the comedic idea, is that you have the world's most desired man, the sexiest man alive, if you ask a lot of people, playing... this person who is really not at all appealing in any way, especially, you know, the way he just is brutally beaten and he has to resort to using a gun, which in this movie is kind of a very... This movie is an interesting relationship with firearms, the way that it kind of disrespects them, sees it as sort of a punkish way to engage your enemy.
Yeah, especially because you may just end up killing 30 unarmed civilians and completely miss your enemy.
Yes, exactly. So,
oh yeah, that was disturbing.
So,
worst
you know,
man ever.
The way that it treats him as a character, I found highly amusing, and I think that there's a certain criticism which accompanies it, which I just don't see. I don't agree with at all. So,
yeah. Okay. Well, anyone else have any thoughts to add on to this movie? Now that we've spoken for, I was going to say almost as long as the movie itself.
I'm really looking forward to watching it again. I don't know if I'll you know buy it on VOD, but I'll rent the DVD from Netflix. And
I'm definitely gonna watch it again before it expires, and I'm probably gonna buy the Blu-ray.
Okay.
Danny, probably not so much.
I don't know.
You did say that you wanted to watch it again. Now
it's a good conversation.
I say watch it again and then think about everything we've said and then come back.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of... I feel like you did a good job of endorsing it just because most positive reviews of this film will kind of just talk about how it's a good sort of atmospheric exercise. But, you know, you just went into those themes and those ideas, and I'm kind of just like, got to go back and sort through them.
Hell yeah, man. Well, I don't know. I think it's one of those things where I was thinking about it, and I'm like, I'm a Catholic. You know, I have a sense of morality that I attempt to hold on to every now and then. And so I was wondering how much a person would miss if they didn't have that upbringing or that way of looking at the world.
Mm-hmm.
Because, yeah, to me, this is a very moral film, like, as hilarious as that may sound. Like, and it's explicated again in the scene where a bar owner is being tortured viciously, and, you know, Chang, the god character, comes in and is basically like, look, tell me what's up, and this will be easy. And the guy attempts to, you know, exert his force of will and, you know, be a strong man and act as though he has power that he doesn't have. And, you know, the Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away. I think Chang even says something along the lines of, you know, you have eyes but you don't see, so it's better not to have eyes. And then you can imagine what he does then, people listening at home.
You can imagine what he does in a long close-up shot.
Yeah. Oh, God. When he did the second eye, I was like, please don't close up again. I know. I understand. I get it. And they didn't, so I was happy. Because it's things like that. Like, some people say the movie is overtly violent for the point of violence. But, you know, if it really was, I feel like he would have stayed on close-up through the entire thing. There were ways to make this movie the kind of exploitative violence that people seem to want to saddle it with. And I think that they only did it enough so that you understand the viciousness and the impact of what's happening. So yeah, that's my final thoughts on this film. Also, if you're a bar owner and you're in the underworld, try not to have so many pointy things in your bar.
Really dangerous.
Really quite dangerous. So that's it. Only God Forgives is on VOD and in limited release now. You can check it out on your cable box like I did. Yeah, so let's talk about what is coming out to Blu-ray and DVD. We have a couple of Criterion Blu-ray releases. There's The Ice Storm and Babette's Feast. We have Welcome to the Punch, which I know is a film that we had spoken about kind of randomly earlier this year, as well as Twixt, which I know we spoke about not too long ago.
Ooh,
as well.
Yeah!
Twixt!
Yeah, we talked a little bit about Twixt and our interest in seeing that. Hey guys, remember Trance? It's funny that this actually happened, because when I was walking to somewhere the other day, someone had mentioned Danny Boyle, and I was like, oh man, I love Danny Boyle, what's he been doing recently? And I was like, oh right, Trance. And then I was actually going to tweet out, hey guys, remember Trance? Oh no, me neither. And then it turns out that it's coming out on Tuesday.
Yeah,
so July 23rd you can Redbox Trance if you're looking for a real disappointment.
I already pre-ordered like 5 copies,
and you got an iPad.
Yeah.
Danny, I love Trance King.
Actually, if you think about it, Trance and Only God Forgives are sort of comparable in the sense that they both kind of came after their director's sort of mainstream breakthrough a little bit, like Refn putting out Only God Forgives after Drive and kind of rejecting what that movie's about, and then Danny Boyle making this wacky movie after kind of winning an Oscar.
Right.
And directing the London Olympics opening ceremony.
Yeah, very crowd-pleasing work.
Yeah.
I was actually thinking how Only God Forgives is sort of to Drive as To the Wonder is to the Tree of Life.
That's
yeah,
very
that's,
true, actually.
That's another
yeah.
one.
And that's not just because both latter films premiered at the 2011 Cannes Film Festival. Yeah. Although maybe that does color my perception a bit. That is something I thought to myself. Yeah. Huh. I don't know. I don't think Malick and Winding Refn really go together, but despite both using Ryan Gosling. But yes, that has been on my mind.
Gosling hasn't been in a Malick movie that's out yet.
No, but he's shooting the untitled one.
The untitled one. The untitled one is not Knight of Cups.
No, because that has a title.
Right. I'm just like, for a while I was confused because I know he had To the Wonder and then I know he had Knight of Cups and then every once in a while it was like untitled and he keeps using the same people and it's just weird that he's made like, or is making, or I don't even know, 3 movies almost concurrently being released in sequence. It was very difficult for a while to keep my head around what was happening. That title
yeah,
one was originally going to be Lawless, correct?
Yeah, I remember that.
And then Hillcoat cock-blocked that
one. I was really upset about that decision. Anyway.
You gonna be okay?
No. I think we've already established that I will never be okay. Anyway, DVDs should we recommend, guys?
Well, I was gonna say I'm planning to write a piece on the ice storm, and I'm almost done reading the book, which was written by Rick Moody. I don't know. Do you know anything about him, Brian?
His name is Rick Moody, and he wrote The Ice Storm.
All right. I'm enjoying the book, and then I'm eager to rewatch the film, which is really quite good. And I'm actually upset because when I was kind of a Criterion novice, I bought the DVD of The Ice Storm. So I think writing this piece will be sort of like a bittersweet experience because I don't know if I have the money to, you know, own both the DVD and the Blu-ray.
Oh, poor Danny. Yeah.
So,
all right.
Yeah.
Nick, did any of these strike you as something to check out?
Want to see Twixt.
Yeah.
Want to see Twixt.
Yeah.
I believe I might be getting sent a Blu-ray of that, so we'll see. We'll see how that works out. If not, it's been on Amazon Instant Video for a bit, so if I don't get it, I'll just rent it from there. Also, speaking of some topics that came up today, The Driver...
Yeah,
Walter Hill's The Driver is being released on Blu-ray.
Oh yeah,
haven't seen that.
Very direct influence on Drive. You should see it. It's a very strong piece of work. Otherwise, no, not much that's exciting. There's Welcome to the Punch.
I really want to see Welcome to the Punch.
With James McAvoy and
I like the title.
Mark Strong. So someone said, I forget who, but someone said it. It's too bad there isn't an exchange of dialogue in the movie where a character says "Welcome to the Punch" and then punches somebody in the face.
I mean, I would expect that. Also, Paul Walker's Vehicle 19.
Wow.
Yeah. Let's see. Tagline for this. He picked the wrong car. They picked the wrong guy.
That sounds really good,
coming
actually.
To Blu-ray and DVD, Paul Walker. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about what's coming out July 26th. There's The Wolverine, directed by James Mangold, who did Walk the Line and the remake of 310 to Yuma. There is The To-Do List, starring Aubrey Plaza, Bill Hader, Aaliyah Shawcott, and a couple of other people. And we also have Blue Jasmine, the newest from Woody Allen, starring Cate Blanchett, Alec Baldwin, Sally Hawkins, and Peter Sarsgaard. A, has anyone seen any of these? B, do we want to see any of them?
We've got a Blue Jasmine fan among us.
I was about to say, I know that
Donnie's
got a little bit of a hard-on for Blue Jasmine.
It's,
I don't want to imagine Danny with a hard-on.
It was a good movie. Got the review up at the site. If you want further thoughts, there. I don't know.
It actually just reads the entire review. Just reads it was a good movie.
It was very good and well done. B+. And then also coming out next week for New Yorkers at Film Forum. They're showing Joseph Losey's The Servant.
Prequel to The Butler, correct?
It's not. A lot of people will probably make that mistake. It's very different, but it's really good, and I look forward to seeing it on the big screen with a bigger image than perhaps a computer.
Okay. Nick, what are your thoughts on these?
Looking forward to Blue Jasmine, certainly, especially Danny's excellent review, sort of got the anticipation juices flowing. The Wolverine, I've heard, is good, which is weird because I expected it to be horrible.
I've actually been kind of excited for The Wolverine.
Yeah.
Right.
I've heard it's good,
so we'll see what happens there. I guess we'll be reviewing that because Blue Jasmine won't be wide.
Right.
So it might be coming down. So thankfully, it's good to hear. I mean, it's always good to hear when a movie supposedly turns out well, but especially this, because when you have to go see it, it's like, oh, okay, this won't be a waste of time and money. So yeah.
No, I've really liked the previews for The Wolverine that I've seen, and Hugh Jackman is compulsively watchable.
Sure.
And I enjoyed both 310 to Yuma and Walk the Line. So.
All right, so maybe we're in business with that. We'll see. I'm sure it'll be
People will find out next week what we thought about it.
Yeah.
The To-Do List, I just watched the trailer before we did this, and it looks abysmal.
Yeah, it looks pretty bad.
I love Aubrey Plaza. She has been great in everything that I've seen her in. I loved her in Safety Not Guaranteed, and of course Parks and Recreation she's good in, and a little movie called The Mystery Team. And mm-hmm. holy shit, this movie looks terrible.
So, yeah, I'm not an Aubrey Plaza fan, so I could really do without this.
I was about to say, so you dislike it even more than I do.
Yes, even in my beloved Scott Pilgrim, I don't really enjoy her presence. That's how much Brian...
She was in that movie?
Yes, she was. It's a small role, but okay. It's just kind of her... I'm not a fan.
Okay. So. Damn. All right. Well, you don't like Aubrey Plaza. I don't like Scott Pilgrim. That's it. So let's talk about a review or a recommendation, something that we watched on our own, and then we can get out of here. So, Nick, let's start with you.
You want me to recommend a movie?
Yeah, the recommendation.
I don't know why I'm laughing.
What the hell is going on?
Anyway, so there was the news this week that an alternate version of a old Buster Keaton, I mean, not that any of his movies are new, but an old Buster Keaton film had been uncovered. And I guess I kind of got in the mood to watch some more of his work. I'd only seen The General, unfortunately. So I went on Netflix, and there's a few of his features that are readily available from the help of the good people at Kino. And I give a watch to two films. I'm going to go with a movie called Seven Chances, which is a very simple premise. A man has to get married by 7 p.m. so he can inherit millions and millions of dollars from a deceased relative. And like a lot of silent comedies, sort of the plot becomes a bit secondary to the slapstick and the spectacle of it all. But what spectacle it is. There's a climactic boulder chase scene that I tweeted last night, and this holds true since then, mm-hmm. that is better than any action scene from 2013. It's a really wonderful, exciting piece of work, and it lasts for something. The movie's only about an hour. It lasts for something like 20 minutes, too. Jesus. So about a third of the movie is the character running, which is, it's hard to go wrong there. It's a really fun movie. It's on Netflix. It won't take you much time. So please, give it a gander.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
All right. And Danny, what about yourself?
Most of my viewing lately has been with the John Cassavetes retrospective going on in Brooklyn, New York, USA. Different borough than Manhattan, if you're sure. All right, never mind. I've seen a handful of films. One I really like that I think is one of his rarer titles is called Minnie and Moskowitz. I think of it as like one of the most violent screwball comedies ever made, because these characters just slap each other and punch each other like the whole movie. But it's pretty clear that they're in love and they're eventually going to kind of accept that. So it's sort of a weird balance between like horrific violence and very funny physical gags that makes for an interesting experience. The two lead actors are Seymour Cassell and Gina Rowlands, who worked with Cassavetes on multiple occasions. And Cassavetes appears himself in a supporting role. That's actually quite sad and probably like the most disturbing thing in the movie. He has like an opening scene where Rowlands comes home, and it's his first scene. We see him and we're like, oh, cool, it's John Cassavetes with his wife. And then he just kind of like slaps her like 10 times, and then she hits him back, and very upsetting. The movie overall is oddly uplifting, despite what I just said about that disturbing scene. So watch it sometime.
All right. Excellent.
Minnie Moskowitz. Yeah. Does anybody say that in the movie? Does anybody say Minnie and Moskowitz with sort of a kind of a ratty New York accent?
Yeah, there's actually Cassavetes has a recurring voiceover where he just says that like every 5 minutes. It's really interesting.
All right. Well, my personal choice, I guess I'm going to do two, because I don't think that you're actually going to be able to see one of them. So I'll say the one that I watched this morning was Byzantium.
Oh, man. I want to see that.
It's really good, guys. Really quite wonderful. Byzantium, directed by Neil Jordan, written by Moira Buffini. And it's starring... God. Hey, Nick, how do you say Saoirse Ronan's name?
Saoirse Ronan.
Saoirse Ronan?
Yeah.
Okay. And it's starring Saoirse Ronan, Gemma Arterton, and Caleb Landry Jones, amongst a few other notable character actors that people will recognize. And it is a vampire story, hold your anger, that takes place in the UK. Two female vampires trying to make their way and avoid detection. It is a fantastic drama that touches on concepts of family and storytelling and the need for human contact, as well as vengeance and really kind of the way that men exploit women, oddly enough. So that's awesome. A lot to chew on in this film. Fantastic performances, beautiful cinematography, expertly directed. You know, just the fact that it's vampires. Like, it was one of those movies where I was like, you know, the vampires could be considered incidental to the plot because it's so rooted in human emotion, except for the fact that without the vampirism, there would be no plot. And I think that's the best way to do a vampire film, if that makes any sense, which hopefully it does. But yeah, fantastic film. I recommend that people check it out. I know that it is going to be at the AFI Silver in Washington, D.C., but it, after having an actual run there that I was completely unaware of, good work marketing, it's only going to be playing for like the next week at like 11 a.m. So that sucks. I don't know if it's in any other cities, but check it out definitely when it comes to DVD or Blu-ray or VOD. So that's my first choice. However, I'm always the lower class one, I feel, when we're talking about these things. So I'm going to lean into it. Last week, I did not enjoy Pacific Rim that much. So I decided to watch another movie involving robots. And I turned on HBO, and what should I find but iRobot? The Alex Proyas movie.
Oh, I haven't seen that.
Really?
Yeah.
It's, okay, so iRobot stars Will Smith, and it was directed by Alex Proyas, who did The Crow, and not much worthwhile since then. And it is a light, but still thought, it's a very heavy amalgamation of thoughtful science fiction and straight-up B-movie pulp action nonsense. This is the movie where I was watching it, and I was like, hey, shit, remember when, like, Will Smith was a good actor that we enjoyed looking forward to watching movies from? And yeah, he's really good in it. Alan Tudyk, who serves as the motion capture and voice for the primary robot, is really fantastic. The direction is interesting, and it's got a little bit of style to it, but it doesn't try to, like, paper over any narrative imperfections with the style. And there are a few narrative imperfections, but this movie came out in 2004, and it's pretty, like, if you think about that 9 years ago, it's pretty prescient, the things that it set up, especially with the announcement of, like, the Xbox One. Like, you know, the Xbox One, it's always watching you. It will listen to you. It needs to be uplinked to the, like, web servers daily to download, and, you know, there's all of these questions of privacy, and that's what these robots are. And so it actually, 9 years later, has proven to be a fairly prescient piece of sci-fi, and yeah, it's good. It's not great. I'm not going to say that it's wonderful and fantastic and you need to see it, but I remember this movie being maligned for some reason, and I just wanted to stake out on record that I think it's a fine film and it's a good time at the movies, and it's not half as stupid as you probably think it is, and Will Smith gives a winning performance.
The late Roger Ebert was a big Alex Proyas fan. I can't remember if he liked iRobot, but he
loved Knowing, didn't he?
Yeah, he was kind of a comically insistent defender of Knowing. I think he'd even made his top 10 of the year.
Yeah, I've not seen Knowing.
And he also loved Dark City, which
Dark
I haven't seen.
Dark City is fan-fucking-tastic.
Yeah, I gotta see that.
Yeah. Dark City's great. It's like a precursor to The Matrix. I think they even filmed parts of The Matrix on the same set. But Dark City's great. iRobot. Oh, yeah, Dark City came after The Crow. All right, I take back what I said earlier. He did Dark City. That's good. And then iRobot's good. And then he just kind of fell off. I don't know what happened. I don't remember if iRobot was financially successful or not, but it's a good time. Nick, you're being suspiciously quiet. Are you angry at me?
No. I was typing something. Sorry.
Have you seen iRobot?
No.
Okay. That's why I'm getting out of this unscathed. No, iRobot, it's good. It's got a very clean, interesting visual palette. A lot of the futurism they pull off is interesting. And, you know, it's just a good story. And the robot presence in it is winning. It's a winning film. I like it. So iRobot or Byzantium, check them out. I watched a couple of other things, but I can't even remember what they are right now. So how good could they have been? And that's it. That's all for today. So join us next week when we'll be talking about James Mangold's The Wolverine. Until that point, you can find us online. We'll tell you where. Danny, start us off.
Oh, yes. Well, as I mentioned, thefilmstage.com for a review of the new Woody Allen picture. Also, thekingbulletin.com and twitter.com/thekingbulletin.
And Nick?
twitter.com/Nick_Newman and thefilmstage.com.
And I can be found at dearfilm.net, my personal blog, as well as thefilmstage.com and twitter.com/Brian J. Rowan. So once again, join us next week, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for stopping by. We'll talk to you next time. And Vidhaya, Jesus Christ. Pranzengrim? Anyone want to help me out with this?
You're on your own.
It's Vidhaya. Pranzengrim.
I don't think he'll mind.
So let's talk about this, gentlemen. After whoever's typing is done typing.
Sorry about that. I thought I was on mute.